Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is a journalist, and I love the characterization that the former Chicago iconic figure, Studs Terkel, used before he passed away recently. Dar is what they call an unembedded journalist, and Studs referred to journalists like Dar as not in bed with journalists because they do the real thing, they do the real reporting. And back between freight months from 2003 into 2005, Dar reported on the ground from Iraq. His dispatches, he calls them Mideast dispatches, they're featured on his website, which is darjamailiraq.com. Dar also has a book about his experiences there. It's called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And Dar returned to Iraq just recently, and he's now back just a couple of days or so. So we want to talk about what's going on in the country. Iraq is off the radar. We don't hear much about Iraq, but this August will mark 19 years since America went to war with Iraq. The bombs didn't start falling until January 1991, and I vividly remember that horrible day. Dar, I welcome you to the program.
Thanks very much for having me, Steve.
Oh, it's wonderful, Dar. The last time I had you scheduled, I was a little under the weather, and I needed my co-host to substitute for me. But today I'm doing fine, so I was really looking forward to today. I felt terrible about last time. The end of June, I remember that so well. Well, you just came back from Iraq a couple of days or so ago, and again, you got a chance to see firsthand what's happening right now compared to what you saw when you spent 8 months there. We have some breaks. When you hear the music, you'll know a break is coming, and I'll interrupt. But let's begin. Talk about what you saw there, and you've been writing about it in some of your dispatches.
Well, you know, it's always one thing to be reading about a situation and then quite another to actually see it firsthand. And, of course, I continued to follow Iraq since my last time in there, which was 4 years ago. And I knew that the infrastructure was getting worse. I knew that people were suffering. There was high unemployment, and it was just a very difficult life. But what really struck me when I got in there the first week, it really had me on my heels just how widespread the suffering is among the Iraqi people. Most segments of the population are continuing to really struggle just to get by. The economy is totally destroyed. There's over 50% unemployment. And while the U.S. is not manning checkpoints anymore, for example, around Baghdad, there are still loads and loads, if not even more, U.S. patrols on the streets than when I was last in there 4 years ago. We have to keep in mind that despite all of this talk about withdrawal, even today, more news coming out about it, there's still over 144,000 U.S. military personnel and over 185,000 private contractors working in that country. So to see it continuing on, there continues to be violence, while there's not nearly as much as there was, say, a year and a half ago, but there do continue to be bombs every day in Baghdad, almost a car bomb every single day in that city, checkpoints everywhere. It's still just an extremely difficult life.
We need to take a break. There's no question this is going on, and it is so outrageous. We destroyed that country. We literally destroyed it. We can talk about it. I've written a fair amount about Iraq myself. Oh, it takes my breath away to think about it. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Dar Jamail. My older listeners certainly remember back in the 1980s, I hope they do, when the Reagan administration, the Carter administration began it, and Reagan continued it through the 1980s, where we managed to get Iraq and Iran to go to war with each other for the better part of that decade and kill a million or more people, wanting both countries to destroy each other so we could walk in and take the oil from both of them. And then, of course, it continued in the 90s, in the new millennium, right up to today, and the country is occupied. And as you say, the car bombs keep going off. The killing keeps going on. The occupation is repressive. The terrible state that we created for those people. You write an article, and I've mentioned this in the past in a few articles that I wrote, where doctors are afraid to come out and treat people, especially women. They're scared. So many of them have been chased out of the country. They're afraid they'll be killed. But you've seen it. You've talked to them.
Yeah, that's right, and that's another situation that continues. And, you know, I would imagine every topic we bring up we'll be able to say this about, but, you know, so many of the horrible things that have been going on in Iraq continue to one degree or another today, despite the fact that they're not being reported. And this is another case in point where, okay, there's a relative lull in the overall violence, but that doesn't mean the kidnappings have stopped. That doesn't mean the doctors, over 50% of which of Iraq's entire medical professional doctors have fled the country because they've been prime targets for killings and assassinations and especially kidnaps because the some of the gangs think that they can fetch a higher ransom from the families. So as a result, when the invasion was launched in 2003, there were 36,000 doctors and medical professionals in Iraq. Now over half of those have fled. And I went to a private hospital to interview doctors when I was in Baghdad, literally just about 2 weeks ago. And there were doctors there. There were literally 13 people living at this hospital. They work there and they live there. And they had to do that because they were too afraid to leave. They had already received death threats. They'd already moved their families out of the country, but they had to have money. Like I said before, jobs are scarce. It's very difficult to get by. So they're working at this private hospital. And can you imagine that that's your life where you go into your job and then you work your 8-10 hour day and then you have to stay there because if you leave, you're too afraid you're going to get killed. So many of these doctors said, yes, I'd received threats. I was told to quit, or most commonly I received an envelope with a single bullet in it. So that's why so many have fled. And as a result, Iraq's medical system, as you know, of course, we have to go back and talk about how the Iran-Iraq war depleted it, and then especially the 12 and a half years of genocidal sanctions that literally brought the entire system to its knees. And there basically hasn't been very much support since the invasion of the medical system. So you go into, for example, the largest hospital in Baghdad, the largest one in Iraq, Baghdad Medical City, and this is a giant compound. There's several buildings there. And, for example, in the biggest building, which is about this 15-story high building, out of 11 elevators, you're lucky if three are working. So if you're a patient and you need to go between floors and you can't walk, you're going to be waiting probably about 45 minutes or an hour just to get an elevator, let alone when you need medication, you're going to be given a prescription from a doctor and say, well, we don't have this because of corruption or whatever, so you're just going to have to go out in the black market and buy it yourself, and you're going to pay about 10 times what it's worth. And that just gives you a very brief overview of that situation. And I think this is so critical because it's not hard for any of us to imagine, you know, when you're sick and you feel horrible and you're in pain and you just want relief and you go into this system that I just described to try to get that relief, and the odds are you're going to end up not getting the medical attention that you deserve. And that's the situation that most Iraqis find themselves in today.
And then compound that with most of the other professions in the country, whether we're talking about education, whatever it is, so many of the people have just fled because there's nothing left in the country for them. What we did to that country, next Wednesday, Dennis Halliday will be on this program. And in 1998, I think for about a year, he was the UN humanitarian chief during the so-called Oil for Food program. And he resigned finally. He couldn't stand it anymore because he said what he was assigned to do was basically be an emissary for genocide, killing maybe back then about 5,000 children every single month. Again, he couldn't stand it. So he'll be on. We'll talk about his experience back in the 1990s. So the killing never stopped. And even the bombing didn't stop during the Clinton years. It wasn't like all-out war. But bombing went on. Very little of it got reported. And, of course, people were dying, hundreds, thousands of people every single month. And who knows? At least a couple of million people have died since 1991 when this started. Genocide is the only word to describe it.
It really is, literally. And Dennis Holliday is who I quote when I say that, in case someone wants to take up issue with my using that word. And I've interviewed him myself, and I applaud the stand that he continues to take to speak out about this. And that's literally what it is. When one government imposes the harshest economic sanctions in history against another one, and all the evidence is there, even from the UN, saying, look, this is killing tens of thousands of people a month, literally. You have to stop. And then in addition to that, and I would imagine, Steve, that you're aware of this too, because these documents came out a long time ago, but during the 91 war, there were studies done by the U.S. military to figure out what would happen if we bomb Iraq's critical infrastructure, like water treatment plants, electrical plants, what diseases are going to come up, what problems are going to occur, and how fast are those going to spread through the population. And those results were found. This is going to be devastating if you bomb the water plants, and then there are sanctions where people can't get materials like chlorine and other things to treat water, let alone medications for diarrhea and such. And those bombings continued, and then the economic sanctions were in place, and then the bombing continued through that. And that's why we have over 500,000 Iraqi children killed just during the sanctions alone, and another 500,000 adults and elderly and women on top of that. So that is why when we use the word genocide, and of course we have to be very careful how we use it, because this is a very condemning, damning word to put out there against the U.S. government. But when you look at the facts on the ground and the evidence that shows not only did the U.S. do this, but this was calculated and well thought out in advance, there is no other word to describe it other than using genocide.
Oh, absolutely, Dyer. And people like Francis Boyle, who's an expert on international law, a humanitarian international law as well, and he's very clear on this. He talks about this in terms of what Israel has done to the Palestinian people, but it certainly applies at least as much to the Iraqi people. And way back, I pulled up an old article that I wrote talking about what we destroyed back in 1991. And it was only a 4 or 5 week war. We killed about 200,000 people. We lost about 140-odd U.S. soldiers, a good number of them from friendly fire. So Saddam didn't exactly put up a fight, nor could he, against the power of the U.S. military. But we literally killed about 200,000 people. And listing what we destroyed, I just read a little bit of it. Power generating stations, dams, water purification capabilities, sewage treatment, disposal systems, telephone and other communications, hospitals, mosques, residential areas, irrigation sites, food processing, storage, distribution facilities, hotels, retail stores, oil wells, chemical plants, factories, government offices, historic sites, on and on and on and on. I mean, these things have nothing to do with the military capability of a country. And, of course, what Israel just did to Gaza, Dar, was exactly the same thing, except no chemical plants there, no oil wells there.
That's right, and that's a very accurate parallel. I mean, this is literally an attempt to wipe out a people. It's not about one conventional military going up against another one. It is about one government's attempt to liquidate the population of another country. I mean, and that's simply what has happened in Iraq. Look, the U.S. government, whether we're talking about the Bush administration or Bush's father's administration or Clinton or now Barack Obama, you can rest assured that these administrations do not care about the welfare of the Iraqi people. If they did, they would withdraw all occupation forces, because that is what the vast majority of Iraqis want, and they would refund all of the reconstruction project money and give it over to Iraqis to do the work. They would completely pull out, and there would be reparations made for the decades of suffering that this government has inflicted upon the people of Iraq. And, you know, the same thing could be said about the state of Israel, where, they couldn't carry out what they're doing without the full backing of the U.S. government. And this is not dependent upon it being a Bush administration or a Republican administration. The Democrats are at least as complicit in this, if not even more so than the Republicans.
Absolutely. It goes back at least to the days of Lyndon Johnson back in the 1960s. It was before that, but it really picked up steam around that time, Israel's 1967 war. U.S. support for Israel has been absolutely appalling. Billions of dollars, all kinds of weapons, any kind of benefit imaginable. And Democrats are usually worse than the Republicans. George Bush was a very, very close ally of Israel, but a regular on this program, James Petras, wrote a marvelous article I like to mention all the time, where he referred to Barack Obama as the first Jewish president. This guy was literally weaned in Chicago, including by the Jewish community of Chicago, to be certain. They saw him as a comer. And they wanted to be certain that this guy was a good friend of Israel. And indeed, he is a good friend of Israel. And there's no question that he simply, in plain English, doesn't give a damn about the Palestinians. And I don't care what he says. He'll do nothing for them. He'll do everything for Israel. Oh, my goodness, I'm getting a little wound up, aren't I? But this is all fact. What you're saying is all fact, and what I'm saying is all fact. Let's take another break, and we'll be right back, Dar.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Dodger Mail. Dar, I think one important topic to explain is why the violence in most of the country has quieted down to a degree. I think a lot less up in the north around Mosul with the Kurdish Arab-Iraqi conflict going on. But in El Anbar province around Baghdad, I guess around Basra as well in the south, there's a lot less violence. My understanding is that for some time, for some months, we bought off the resistance. We put them on the payroll. But I think you know more about this than I do.
Well, I did look into this extensively when I was there. In fact, it was more than any other topic. It's what I spent the most time on. And when you say that the main reason violence is down is because the United States government paid off the resistance, paid them off by forming a 100,000-strong Sunni militia, who is basically comprised, according to the U.S. military, of former resistance fighters who were actively launching attacks and killing American soldiers. There's also members of Al-Qaeda in this new group. They're called the Awakening Groups. The U.S. formed them, supported them for a long time. This started happening even before the so-called surge. The surge really had very little to do with the decrease in violence. It was about paying off the resistance that really brought it down. And this went on until October, and that's when the U.S. military said, okay, we're going to stop paying you guys directly, and the Iraqi government's going to take over and incorporate you into the security forces. Well, that's basically not happening. And in fact, U.S. payment of these people continues, but it's under a completely different rubric. They simply changed the rhetoric where rather than paying them directly, now all of these tribal sheiks who are basically running different groups in these awakening councils have become actively involved in the so-called construction business, because now that's how the U.S. is funneling money into these guys to keep paying these resistance fighters off so that they don't attack Americans. So, for example, I spent a lot of time with this man, Sheikh Afan, who is the head of the Awakening Councils in the city of Fallujah. And this is a guy, let me give you just a brief snapshot. We rode around in Fallujah surrounded by his security forces. He has 900 militiamen under his direct control that he pays. This is a guy who's already received over $250 million of so-called reconstruction funds. We're driving around in a completely destroyed city of Fallujah. It looks like the November siege happened a couple of weeks ago. We're driving around in his $420,000 armored custom-built BMW. This is a guy who carries around wads of $100 bills. We've all heard of the pallets of shrink-wrapped packages of $100 bills. Well, that's how business is done in Iraq. So he gets regular visits from the U.S. military. They keep him supplied with this money that's going to so-called reconstruction projects. And it's really just going into his own personal benefit, and very, very little is happening in Fallujah. But the only reason why violence is, it continues to stay down, at least for the moment, and we're going to have to watch this, because what happens when this money stops coming, when this so-called reconstruction money that's buying off these sheiks and the people directly under their control, what happens when that money stops? And I think that's key, because what's happening, especially in Baghdad, where these Awakening Council groups are now in control of security of many of the neighborhoods in the city, well, some of them haven't been paid since October because the government doesn't want them. They feel that they're a threat. So we're talking about right now, maximum 25% of these Awakening Group fighters have been rolled over into government jobs. Others haven't been paid since October, and I can tell you, as they told me firsthand, their patience is running very, very thin, and this is a situation where something has to give.
Oh, this sounds like a bomb with a lit fuse, Dar. And it's only a question of how long that fuse is. I've truly believed, the little bit I know about Iraqi history and Afghanistan history is both countries absolutely do not want to be occupied. And sooner or later, they will rise up and they will thrust occupiers out. We see it happening in Afghanistan right now, where you can call them the Taliban, you can call them anything you want. I just call them the resistance that wants an occupation force out of their country. And the Taliban, as I understand it, is a very fluid group. The name really belies who they are. It's the resistance. And people move in and out supporting what they feel is important to them. So somebody that may have supported one other group will now join what we call the Taliban because they want the occupation ended. And sending 18,000 more troops over there won't make one bit of difference. Sooner or later, I imagine the Iraqi resistance will rise up again and we'll see more violence in the places where we saw it earlier. But it's happening up north right now. Did you manage to get up there at all?
I didn't, no. I actually didn't get up there because, right, there's a huge U.S. military operation happening in Mosul right now. We're looking at several soldiers killed just in the last couple of days. Mosul and Diyala province and parts of Salahuddin province, this is really where the fight is now. They're huge areas of those geographic spans of Iraq are under the control of fighters, and this continues. So, again, when we say overall violence is down, I'm definitely generalizing because these are still very, very volatile areas, and they're a long way from getting into a position where we're going to actually see something more akin to peace in those areas. I still think that's a long ways off.
The powder keg continues, Dar. It really has no there's no end to this until the occupation ends. And I have very little doubt in my mind that we have no intention of ending the occupation. We would like to bring troops back and let the Iraqis be an Iraqi force be our occupying power so we can pull forces out. But we've built these super bases that are like small cities with every amenity possible on them for the troops that are there. It's like being at home if you don't go off the base. And we're not giving those up. I mean, we built those to be there as long as there's oil in the ground, as long as there's oil in the region. Let's take another break, Darren, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm on with Dodger Mail. Now, with all of this going on, a frequent topic on this program is the global economic crisis and the absolutely unimaginable amounts of money, trillion dollars, way back some decades back, we used to talk about a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money. Well, that's pocket change now. We talk about a trillion here, a trillion there. I've written, Chalmers Johnson has written, some others have written, that if you add up the total military budget, including what's spent at home, Homeland Security, not even the black budgets that we don't know about, this country easily is spending in excess of $1 trillion a year on what we've referred to as defense. including servicing the national debt portion of what we spend on the military that goes into the national debt, servicing that portion of the debt, veterans benefits, meager as they are, everything put together, every category, we're spending over $1 trillion that we can't afford. And on this program and in his books, Chalmers Johnson has explained that, I mean, we simply can't do this. Was before the economic crisis began, Dara. We simply can't go on doing this thing. We'll end up bankrupting the country. There's no question about it. So now we're adding all this other on, dealing with this terrible crisis that we talk about in terms of being another Great Depression, and I believe it. We are really on the road to ruin in many respects, plus having ruined a country like Iraq, Afghanistan, and so much else. It's a disgraceful story. It gets no coverage in the mainstream.
Well, I'm glad that you bring up the economic angle because, you know, when we were just talking about, asking the question, what happens when the U.S. stops paying all these people off so that they won't attack them? And I was kind of alluding to the economic situation there because this is not a permanent situation. What the U.S. is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan globally as an empire, even domestically here, it can't continue. It's completely 100% unsustainable. And our economy is literally evaporating in front of our eyes on a daily basis now. And the U.S. dollar is going to become far, far less of value in days to come. And the U.S.'s ability to continue to fund this empire, the overstretch, the continuing militarism, as you said, spending over $1 trillion a year at least on military-related items alone, this can't continue. And, we had the national spy chief come out not long ago and basically said, look, the economic situation has become the most perilous thing to this country. It's not the war on terror. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's not any of that. It's the economic crisis and the social unrest that's going to cause at home here. Most Americans aren't aware of what it's like to truly suffer, to live in a place where there is no economy. The government just basically won't do anything for you whatsoever. And what's going to happen when that becomes a widespread phenomena here across the United States? There's going to be all kinds of social unrest, and then people here are going to get to see exactly what kind of government there is in this country when they start using our own U.S. military against the people of America. We already have active duty units deployed in certain parts of the country, and I think that's a trend that's going to increase. I mean, it happens historically everywhere. You cannot, as a country, go and occupy a place militarily overseas and not start to suffer severe and usually immediate consequences back at home. As has been said so many times before, we are in a situation right now historically in this country where the chickens are indeed coming back home to roost.
Oh, they're indeed coming home to roost. Back during the Vietnam era, 1960s, 1970s, we overspent domestically and on the Southeast Asian wars. We were lucky because we didn't have the indebtedness back then that we have now. It didn't start really piling up until the Reagan years, 1980s, and then so immensely under George Bush, and currently, I mean, just literally going off the charts into unimaginable numbers. But we spawned a terrible inflation back in the 70s, early 80s. We survived. We stayed solvent. We weren't worried about the country crumbling. But it's truly very, very scary now, and who knows what's going on that we haven't heard about yet, but it is public, and I've mentioned it in articles, that we brought a combat brigade back from Iraq to be stationed, deployed on U.S. streets as needed as of last October 1st. And there was a Washington Post story I quoted shortly after that that said by 2011, I believe the date was, we will commit 20,000 U.S. troops to put down civil disobedience, or in case of a terrorist attack, quote unquote, real or contrived, 20,000 U.S. troops for U.S. streets, as needed, where needed. I think they expect civil unrest. They may want to incite another terror attack. It's very scary what these people may have in mind. it almost seems like something that ought to come out of a Hollywood script. But this is happening in real life. It's affecting us.
Well, it is. And, you know, as we have ample evidence to prove, this is a government, and I don't mean just the Barack Obama administration. I mean, historically, this is a government that's willing to do whatever is necessary to maintain and increase its own power and wealth. And they will go to any lengths. And after seeing everything I've seen in Iraq, as far as what the U.S. military is used for, how they operate, the ruthlessness, the calculated brutality, the psychological warfare, the overt violence in large military operations, and what they use the military to do, whether it's destroy entire cities, kill and attack journalists, detain medical workers, use snipers to target ambulances. I mean, if this is a government that's willing to do that overseas, you can rest well assured. And, of course, there's ample evidence that's been out for decades to show this, that, you know, they will use that against their own people. And they have in the past, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so. Because, again, this is a government that their sole aim at this point is maintaining and continuing to increase the U.S. empire. The fact that Barack Obama talks about wanting to pull troops out of Iraq, and of course this rhetoric, it's amazing to me how sloppy journalism has become in this country, where people just repeat what the administration is saying. Well, as of today, we want to pull all the troops out within 19 months from now. Well, they're not talking about all troops. They're talking about combat troops, and the vast majority of the troops in Iraq are not combat troops. They're desperate to get these troops out because they're probably going to take most of them and pull them out and put them right into Afghanistan, because that is now where the U.S. finds itself in deep, deep trouble. So this is about maintaining two different occupations and leaving open the possibility for war against Iran or other places around the globe. This is not about doing the right thing. This is not about morals. This is not about justice. This is an empire simply rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic so that it can continue to maintain the trajectory that it's been on now for decades.
Oh, indeed. And it's the reason I call the Obama administration George Bush's third term. The baton was passed, and I think literally not a beat was missed. The same policies are being continued. The big difference for me between Obama and Bush is Obama speaks in complete sentences. He's intelligent. I mean, he's a smart guy. There's no question about it. I think he was a star student at Harvard Law School. If it weren't for his daddy, George Bush never would have gotten in, let alone complete the two schools that he went to, Harvard and Yale. But Obama is simply he's the front guy. He occupies that chair in the Oval Office. He continues the same policies. They are destructive. I took a look at I didn't listen to him. I just can't stand listening to the speeches. But I took a look at the text of his speech last night to Congress. One thing in it, there were a lot of audacious things said, as far as I'm concerned. But one audacious statement that he made was more or less that he, along with blame, where else he placed it, he placed blame on the U.S. public for their overspending habits.
Which is really shocking. I mean, it's just amazing, because if you were to compare the amount of money spent by the sum total of the population of people in this country to what the government spends, it's laughable. It's absolutely absurd. I mean, this is, as we just said earlier, this is a government that's spending over $1 trillion every single year on military-related expenses alone. We're talking about these last two bailouts. I mean, put together and adding on the additional expenses with those that came in the aftermath, we're talking about a government that just spent over $2 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money by basically funneling it into extremely corrupt financial institutions in the form of a so-called bailout. And they did this in a matter of just a couple of months. That's $2 trillion. And you know, we're talking about trillions and we're throwing these numbers around. I realized a ways back, I don't really even know what a trillion is. And so I had a friend give me a little tool to use to get some perspective on this. When we're talking about a trillion, how many seconds I'm sorry, if you were going to try to contextualize this, how many years is 1 trillion seconds? It's over 31,000 years. those are the types of numbers that we're talking about here. We're not talking about my kids or grandkids paying this off. We're talking about generations in the future trying to pay this off. But the reality is this is a situation where this money is not ever going to be paid back. The U.S. is in a state of decline. We are basically in a twilight of empire, and the economy is going through the floor as we speak. And things are going to start, I think, within the next 6 to 9 months, start to get very, very ugly at home. We're going to start seeing the true face of the government right here on the streets of the United States.
Oh, there's no question. There will be unrest because people will not get the aid they desperately need. They will react in some way. In April, April 3rd and 4th, I believe the dates, there will be a march on Wall Street. There's a group that is organizing in cities around the country, people to come to New York to march on Wall Street, and they refer to what they're doing as bail out the people or bail out the public instead of bailing out the bank. I'll tell you what a trillion is, Dar. A trillion is an entitlement to the fraudsters, to the banksters, that literally defrauded people through their toxic junk that they created, and they sold this stuff to even to sophisticated buyers who should have been smart enough to know that maybe this stuff isn't what they were told it was by the people who peddled it to them, but they bought it anyway. So there's all this toxic junk sitting around, these assets that nobody would buy unless there's a government guarantee if it goes sour. But it already is sour. And I'm on Social Security. I get a small Social Security check every month. That's my entitlement. If I were one of the big major banks, then I would get all of these multi-billions that they would hand to me. And this would be my entitlement. So the last number I saw was something like 9+ trillion. These are staggering numbers. I mean, it's hard to imagine them. So call them an entitlement for fraudster bankers or banksters, what FDR called bankers way back when. Pretty outrageous. And people are suffering. Poverty is growing in this country. There literally is hunger. I could walk from where I live in downtown Chicago. I could walk. It's a mile or two from where I live. I could walk to where people sometimes go hungry during the day, including kids, including elderly people, people who are really suffering in a modern city, Chicago, and there's hunger almost to the degree of some degree of starvation. Outrageous.
And that's another thing. You know, we talk about media coverage of Iraq all the time and how dismal it is. Well, this is another case in point. People in these areas can see very clearly in these really desperate areas of the country, like you mentioned, still down in New Orleans, and we could go down, I'm sure, an extremely long list where there are no jobs. People are struggling. They're only getting by with help of neighbors, et cetera. There is no government to speak of as far as, an institution that would actually try to help people out. And where's the media coverage on this? I mean, it's few and far between at best. And yet this is a growing crisis. And then all of a sudden it's going to really start to explode. And, the media maybe then will cover it. But right now, it needs to be giving a voice to these people because these two, just like the Iraqi people, the people of Afghanistan, Palestinians in Gaza, these are all people who are victims of the policies of the U.S. government. And now we have the same thing happening right here at home.
Oh, indeed. And of course, the media has done such an atrocious job on this. The housing bubble peaked in 2006. Well, maybe people could have missed it back then, but the trouble started percolating in 2007. There were no reports in the major media about what was going on, and only as things really got ugly last year, it no longer could be covered up. Then reports would come out, and of course reports are out now, but they still downplay the extent of exactly what's going on. In one sense, you could call it denial. I call it suppression. They simply don't want to scare people. So in terms of talking about the economy, in terms of enticing people about investing, the common terminology are things like, well, the bottom is in and it's a recession, but, the second half of the year will be better. It's not as good as we want. Well, for certain, 2010 will be much better. We'll get through this thing. Bernanke just said that to the Senate committee. I think he said it with a degree of hope. not a flat statement that we will solve it this year and 2010 will be recovery. I think he said it in terms of he was hopeful if we do the right things, then 2010 will be recovery. I don't think there'll be any recovery in 2010. I think 2009 will be extremely turbulent. 2010, well, who knows? It could end up worse than this year. We have a very, very rocky time ahead. One statistic I heard, Dar, it may be worse now. I heard that on average, a job is lost in this country now about every 5 seconds.
That doesn't surprise me, and I think these are trends that are all going to continue. As bad as it is now, we are still on the front end of this collapse, and things are going to get unimaginably ugly here. I mean, I think at this point, what's keeping this country going, why some people are still able to go fly and take trips, et cetera, and still have some money in the bank is we're basically running on inertia at this point. I feel like the bus has already gone off the cliff and is starting to go down, but with inertia just from what work and what's been generated in the past is continuing it to move forward somewhat. But I think now the speed of the decline is increasing, and that inertia is certainly decreasing.
I can remember reading something, this goes back several years, but one analyst believing that the decline of the U.S. began probably around the 1970s, maybe the late 1960s because of Vietnam, that started dragging us down. And the trend has continued ever since. But George Bush, once he came into office, his policies greatly accelerated it. And I think part of the plan was that they wanted to do radical things trying to pull us out of this malaise. And instead, they deepened the malaise. They speeded up the decline. And I don't see Obama doing anything to halt it. Let's take another break, Darren. We'll come back for the last segment. Welcome back. Finishing up now with Dodger Mail. Darren, I want to mention your website again. I'll spell your name for people who aren't as familiar with it as I am. Dahr, D-A-H-R, Jamail, J-A-M-A-I-L. And the website is dahrjamailiraq.com. And your book, Dahr, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Are you working on a new book, by the way?
I am actually, as we speak, I'm working on a book about resistance in the U.S. military against the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, and there is much more resistance than most people would imagine, and the book is scheduled to come out sometime later on this summer.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you absolutely have to come back when you get that book out so we can talk about it. You promise?
I'd love to.
Oh, I love promoting good books. I just want people to know about them because this is the kind of material, this is the kind of information we need. And you do exceptional work. My hat's off to you for what you've done. You went right into the lion's den and saw what was going on, and you told it the way it needs to be told. There are far, far too few people like you. I salute you, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I really appreciate those
kind
words.
I mean every word of it. A few final comments, Dahr, on how you assess Iraq and what's going on and what you see ahead.
Well, basically, that it's a situation that people need to continue to pay very close attention to. It's anything but resolved. In fact, one could easily argue when you look at the political climate that the occupation has created there that things are more volatile and unstable now than ever before. Most Iraqis I spoke with in there felt like this is a calm before what could be even a much larger storm than anything we've seen there in the past. The situation in Kurdistan regarding Kirkuk is completely unresolved. The government is very, very fractured. There are lots of groups without any political representation, and the situation continues to be very bad, as we discussed earlier. So I just encourage people to find ways to stay in touch with what's going on over there, because at some point in the future, we're going to be hearing a lot more about Iraq again.
Oh, indeed, we will hear a lot more about it. And, Dahr, I do hope you'll come back. We need to continue this conversation. I thank you very, very much for coming on. This has been a great hour, a very important hour. Tomorrow, by the way, I will have a victim of U.S. torture since Obama became president. he signed an executive order supposedly banning torture. Well, there'll be an individual on this program who in recent days has been tortured, and we'll discuss it on the program tomorrow. But again, my thanks to you, Dar, and I hope listeners will come back tomorrow. We'll have another live program. We'll have an archive repeat on Friday. And then as of now, we have three live programs next week. I mentioned next Wednesday we'll have Dennis Halliday on, his experiences in Iraq and also what he's been doing now. He lectures frequently, and it'll be wonderful having him on. Dar, again, my great thanks to you for coming on. Oh, did we get cut off? Oh, my goodness. we'll finish up. We will reach the cutoff point momentarily, but I hope you will make it a practice to listen to this program. We try very hard to cover cutting-edge topics with the best guests, distinguished people we bring on to discuss the most important things we need to know about. This is our mission. We'll continue doing it. Please come back tomorrow for another program.